BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Our next guest is an associate professor at Boise State University. College of Business, former lawyer, who writes about sports law as it pertains to college, and he geeks out on it. Now, the challenge with any of this stuff is to make it digestible for the audience. I am well aware. I spent how many months, you know, talking about realignment, talking about the Pac-12, media rights deals. Just some folks that would not want to talk about that because it's not sexy. Sam Ehrlich is going to try to help us digest something that happened today with the Department of Justice. It was very interesting. Statement of interest filed in the House v. NCAA case. What is going on with this? And I'm going to just pepper Sam, the good professor, with a bunch of questions about sports law and things that are going on. And I'm going to guess that because he is in the business, I don't want to say he dumbs it down because he doesn't. That's not what professors do. But professors tend to do a really nice job of what? Taking complex material and sort of, conveying that to an audience themselves in a classroom setting. The good professor from Boise State joining us now. How you doing? How was my intro?
I'm doing great. That was great. So not quite an associate professor yet, just an assistant professor. Hopefully next year I'll get tenure, but, you know.
How does that work? How does that work, by the way? Like, can we talk tenure for a second? Like, because sure. I feel like I've been doing this radio show like almost 20 years. I feel like I should be a tenured professor on the airwaves. But, like, how does that work on a typical campus, that tenure, and how much do you guys talk about that stuff?
I mean, probably could be, and it's something that we do talk about quite a bit. As a tenure track professor, it's something that it's kind of a brass ring. It's really kind of what we're looking for. Essentially how it works, at least at Boise State and certain schools have a little bit different processes. But at Boise State, once I'm there for 5 years, which will be currently in year five, I'll be able to go up for tenure. And at that point, I guess it makes it a little more difficult to fire me. It gives me a little more academic freedom. And, yeah, I'll just go through that process and submit all my materials, submit my application, and hopefully they say yes.
Is this like getting confirmed for a cabinet position where people pepper you with questions, or is it more of a formality and a rubber stamp?
Fortunately, not that stressful, but I wouldn't quite call it a formality and a rubber stamp. I guess it depends on who it is, but fortunately, no confirmation hearing, no questions, but a big packet that I put together, so that part's not as fun.
Well, Sam, I appreciate you coming on. If they call me, I will say he's good by me. The U.S. Department of Justice filed a statement in this House versus NCAA case. We all thought, this is moving along. $20.5 million is going to be the number. What is this statement about? Can you help us with what's going on here?
Sure, of course. It's really kind of an interesting statement. It's really kind of an interesting move by the Department of Justice to kind of weigh in on the House settlement, especially at this stage, and especially, you know, just a few days before a change in administration, which might change the Department of Justice's position on this. Mm. But what they're saying, essentially, is what they're saying, and I'm glad you brought up the $20.5 million revenue sharing cap that really central to the settlement, and I think a really, really big part of the settlement, because that's exactly what they take an issue with. They feel that having a cap on compensation, they feel like having a cap on revenue sharing, instead of letting schools kind of be dictated by more by the free market and pay whatever they're willing to pay the players, they feel that would continue to violate antitrust law, which is, they feel, I mean, it's central to the House case in general, the idea that you can't cap player compensation, that you can't price fix player compensation across the board among a bunch of different schools. And the DOJ is kind of weighing in and saying, well, you can't really solve one price fixing problem by creating a new price fixing regime.
Does Like, if there is a groan that goes up, is the groan coming from, you know, what kinds of schools or what level? You know, is it the haves? Is it the have-nots? Is it just lawyers in general, or some of the schools that thought, hey, at least we now have the target? Who is groaning today?
I think everyone aside from the major haves is going to be groaning today, at least a little bit, because because the $20.5 million was clearly designed to try to rein in, to try to have some semblance moving forward of some sort of competitive balance, so that the Ohio States and the Notre Dames and all the schools that can afford to pay much more than $20.5 million in revenue sharing, and certainly would be happy to pay much more than $20.5 million in revenue sharing, if the DOJ has their way, then they're going to be able to pay more than that, and the schools that really wouldn't be able to come close to that number, that wouldn't be able to afford that, are going to struggle to compete with them even more.
We're talking to Sam Ehrlich, who is a professor at Boise State in the College of Business. It's interesting to me to see that this is happening right before you get a new administration in. Is it your feeling, or is there a strategy there? Does the new administration's policy change, or is that a non-starter, and is it irrelevant? You tell me how you read it.
I definitely think there's a strategy here, because I think we can really kind of compare this to the big news from yesterday, which was kind of a similar kind of thing, where the Department of Education, specifically the Office of Civil Rights within the Department of Education, issued a memo saying that, hey, when you have revenue sharing under the House settlement, if you do end up kind of getting there, it has to be based on Title IX. It has to be distributed proportionally based between men and women. And now a day later, we have the Department of Justice saying almost something a little bit contradictory, but I think it's kind of tailored towards a similar kind of perspective, which is we want to get this out there before the new administration comes in and force the new administration to either rescind it or to kind of leave it in place. It kind of gets the ball rolling. It kind of creates policy. It creates this outgoing administration's policy that they would prefer, I'm sure, to continue. And it kind of puts the onus on the incoming administration to rescind it or overturn it or say something different.
There is a lawsuit, currently working its way through the system, rooted in the state of Oregon, where the women's beach volleyball team at the University of Oregon is suing. I have been told that, to keep an eye on that, because there are some Title IX implications. And at the center of that suit is the fact that they say, hey, look, we represent 48% of the athletes, and we get a far less percentage of distribution of NIL money. Does that move yesterday with the Department of Education, does that signal that maybe the case in Oregon won't set the precedent, or should we still be keeping an eye on it, Sam?
I'd actually say the exact opposite. Not that it wouldn't set a precedent, but I think it becomes all the more important. I think that Schroeder case becomes incredibly important now, because I think there's some briefing due from the plaintiffs on January 31st, if I remember correctly, just following that case. And I fully imagine they are going to cite that memo, the Department of Education memo, in their case to really make the argument that their claim is correct, that their grievance here regarding NIL, regarding the Division III Collective, is correct, that Oregon had an obligation under Title IX to make sure that collectives, that the NIL opportunities provided by the collective are proportional based on gender.
Fascinating stuff. And, I appreciate people like you who, take some time to kind of study it and explain it to the rest of us, because so much of this job, Sam, as you know, is pivoted from covering games and covering athletes to figuring out realignment. We've got a lawsuit involving, the Pac-12 and the Mountain West Conference. If I can linger on that a little bit, Pac-12 signs this deal with the Mountain West, agreeing to have some games that they would play this last college football season and pay the Mountain West $14 million to play those games. And then they included a poaching penalty as part of that. There's now an antitrust lawsuit, or a lawsuit that cites the Sherman antitrust law, that the Pac-12 is saying, hey, we signed this under duress, and the Mountain West is saying, hey, a deal's a deal. I've been told, Sam, that usually these things end up in the middle and they get settled, but how are you reading that one? Because at Boise State, I got to think there's been some focus on what's going on with the Pac-12 and the Mountain West.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, to be clear up front, I am a Boise State employee, and given our involvement in the lawsuit, I do want to kind of make clear that I'm speaking just on my own behalf instead of on Boise State's behalf. But that lawsuit's really interesting, and not just for me as a Boise State guy, as someone who is going to be really excited about joining the Pac-12 and would definitely like the Pac-12 to have a little bit more money to be able to continue to go after the Memphises and the Tulanes of the world. But really just in general, even looking beyond the Boise State angle to that, that's a really interesting lawsuit because it makes a lot of really interesting claims. For one, the antitrust claim, the idea that the Mountain West kind of banded together and they said, well, none of us are going to sign any kind of scheduling agreement with you individually. Instead, we're going to force you to kind of sign this one big scheduling agreement that kind of includes all of us and includes this poaching clause that the Pac-12 certainly sees, at least now, as anti-competitive, something that they shouldn't have had to sign. But also the idea that this poaching fee, and this is another kind of central part of the lawsuit, the fact that the idea that this poaching fee is a penalty instead of an actual summation of what the damages that the Mountain West would suffer from a breach of contract, which, looking at contract law, you know, one of the basic ideas of contract law is that when you have what we call liquidated damages, which are damages that are spelled out in the contract, damages that are included as essentially a buyout. I mean, you see it in coaching contracts all the time. They should accurately represent the damages that the non-breaching party is going to suffer. They shouldn't be just penalties. They shouldn't be, hey, we're going to punish you for breaching this contract. So that's a big part of what the Pac-12 is arguing as well. And I think that really, I mean, it's a really similar theory to what we're seeing out of Florida State and Clemson as well. So if that theory does work, then it might be something that could have broader ramifications across college sports.
There's been some talk about the transfer portal windows. Now you've got the December window, you got the spring window. Coaches don't like the spring window. Is there legal exposure if, you know, the NCAA tries to roll back one of those windows? Could athletes organize and say, hey, wait a minute, what are you doing here? We're not, we haven't negotiated that.
Absolutely, 100%. I think that's something that would be very ripe for athletes to go after. And forget athletes. I mean, looking at how the transfer portal originally opened up, how we originally got away from the year in residence rule, it wasn't athletes, it was the attorneys general of Ohio and West Virginia and all these different states, including the U.S. Department of Justice, who filed that lawsuit originally and got that injunction. So I think that's something that not only the athletes and their representatives and attorneys who are looking to represent athletes, I think that's something the attorneys general are looking at as well. And I mean, we've already seen it win. We've already seen that claim win. I think trying to pare back, there's definitely going to be a limit to how much the NCAA is going to be able to pare that back and still say that they're complying with the injunction that went to place in the Ohio case.
Sam Ehrlich is with us, assistant professor, Boise State College of Business and Economics. Look, you're a former lawyer who now writes about college sports law. Help us out with the House case. Like, I was excited to have it be over. We've been talking about it for months. Felt like everybody knew what they were doing. Are we now facing months and months of this dragging on, or is this something that can be fixed fairly soon and worked through maybe in the next month or so?
Yeah, I'm not too convinced it's over. I'm not too convinced that even today's news is going to be all that impactful. I mean, to be clear, a statement of interest from the Department of Justice saying we don't like this settlement, it carries a good amount of weight. It carries pretty strong weight. But at the end of the day, it's going to really just be in the sole judgment of Judge Wilkin in the Northern District of California to determine whether the settlement is fair and reasonable, and that's really going to be her standard. We have a lot of athletes who have weighed in already and said that they don't think the settlement is fair. I fully imagine and expect we're going to get more voices coming in and saying that the settlement isn't fair and reasonable. But we already had quite a few objections leading up to the preliminary approval hearing, and Judge Wilkin really didn't seem all that interested in them. And maybe it's going to be different when we get to final approval, but you think, especially if some of those arguments are essentially restating what they argued at preliminary approval, I would fully imagine Judge Wilkin to kind of default to what she decided before and what she kind of realized before and what she felt before.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, I think, you know, a statement of interest from the Department of Justice saying it's unreasonable is going to carry some weight. But, again, the judgment's really, it's all going to go back to Judge Wilkin. And given how she's spoken about the settlement in the past, how she's on record speaking about the settlement, I still think there's a pretty good chance that it does get approved, even if it has the modifications.
It feels to me like, you know, maybe professors of 20 years ago were talking about things that were happening on another planet, and you know, now you can walk into your classroom and say, hey, look, this impacts students at Boise State. You probably there could be people in your classes that you say, hey, you know, you're an athlete, you're a volleyball player, you know, you potentially could, this is real world to you. Does it have that feel to you, being somebody who's teaching on a campus?
100%. Absolutely. I mean, because, yeah, I've had a good amount of athletes in my classes, and you know, they're all really interested in this. I've had really good conversations with the athletes, with members of our athletic department. I mean, this is really interesting real-world stuff, and it's kind of in a realm right now where there's a lot of really good questions about this. There's a lot of things that I don't know about the settlement that still have to kind of weigh out moving forward as we kind of figure out what Judge Wilkin's going to do about this and how she's going to react to it. So I think following all of this, it's a great academic exercise for my students just to see kind of the impact of the law and the impact of these negotiations, of these kind of legal discussions on something that they, you know, Boise State, college sports is a pretty big deal. We really enjoy our college sports at Boise State. We enjoy our Broncos, and being able to connect that to a lot of the legal concepts that we talk about in class has been really, really rewarding.
I remember when nobody had heard about the House case, and I had I had somebody who was hired as an expert witness or a consultant by one of the sides, as the House versus the NCAA. I believe this person was on the House side, reached out to me and said, hey, something's coming here that's going to change college athletics. And nobody was talking about House at that point. What are we missing, Sam? What's on the horizon that you're going, I really would be curious to see how fill in the blank goes. Is there something coming after all of this? Is it realignment? Is it, you know, the negotiation of the CFP? Is it something from the DOJ? Is it Congress potentially sticking its hands into college athletics and going, hey, there's an antitrust issue here? What's on your radar?
I think the biggest thing, and this isn't necessarily something that people aren't thinking about, I think it's a central part of this discussion, but I think it's one thing that people don't realize necessarily how close it is and how much of a threat it could be to the way that a lot of athletic departments run things, and that is employment. That is the idea that college athletes may be considered employees of their athletic departments and of the universities really in the near future. Because, you know, it seems like something that, you know, is just this faraway discussion, but we did have a court of appeals, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, just this summer decide that at least some athletes should be considered employees. And the definitions that they drew, you really have to dig into that case, but the definitions they drew are really incredibly broad. I mean, they go back to this idea of athletics being at the front porch of the university, the idea that athletics kind of provides this really kind of window looking, you know, this exposure for the university. It names a bunch of schools that have really benefited from that, including Boise State. And that draws a much broader definition than I think a lot of people are prepared for and a lot of people are expecting. And that case continues to work its way through the court system. So it's very possible that Congress does stick its hands in here. I mean, we've been talking about that for, I feel like, about 4 or 5 years now, and they still haven't done anything. This administration might do something different. There might be more kind of need for them to do something now. But if they don't, then that case is going to be coming soon, and that case is going to be one that it's already clear that it's not going to go well for the NCAA.
Guy I'm watching is Senator Michael Baumgartner, state of Washington. He was the guy, Sam, who taught that insurgent warfare class with Mike Leach. He's a little bit of a disruptor, and he is also he hails from the jurisdiction of the area where Washington State lies. And so that's a guy that I think is going to be interesting to watch in Congress. So keep an eye on him. Sam Ehrlich, Boise State. Thank you, man. I appreciate you joining us. Good follow on Twitter. Keep doing what you're doing.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me on, John. Anytime.
There he goes. The assistant professor. See, when you say assistant professor, you think like kind of like a Dwight Schrute situation, assistant to the regional manager. It's not the case. See, that's why he explained tenure. He's a professor, but he's looking for tenure, and then he loses the assistant, and then he can become an associate or a professor or whatnot. I don't know. Titles. Steven, do you need a title?
No, I don't.
Do you need a, you know, production guru, wizard?
I mean, I would take it. I'll take it. I don't need it, though. Like, my ego does not need that. I can tell you that.
I'm not a big title guy either. Like, you know, you don't need a... I don't have a business card right now. I used to back in the day. I used to, you know, all the six newspapers I worked for, they give you a box of business cards, you know, right when you get there. And you'd be like, sports columnist on it. And I'm like, I'm real excited about that. And I still have those full boxes of business cards from all those stops. I'm like, I never really gave them out. Do people hand out business cards anymore? Is that a thing? I guess if you're in sales, you do it. If you're a realtor, you do it. But I don't think people are walking around like they used to, handing out business cards. I think there's a whole industry there that has maybe gone a different direction. Plus, you can bump your phone, you know, follow me on the socials. My number's everywhere.
Seems like a waste of paper.
It's a little formal. I've always wanted, though, just a business card with my phone number on it. Then you hand that over. Ooh, that's kind of a flex. Then I had one time this guy who had this card. I think it's called the Dot. And I was in Vegas. I was at the Pac-12 championship game when Oregon played Washington. And this dude was working for one of the casinos. He was like the VIP, you know, vice president at one of the big casinos. And he's a huge college football fan. And he was like, oh, my gosh, I read you. You know, shoot me a text. And I was like, I don't have your number. And he pulls out this card and he holds it against my phone. And all of a sudden, all of his info pops up on my phone. It was a pretty cool flex. And like his Twitter and everything popped up on my phone. So I told Anna about it. And she was like, oh, yeah, I'll order you one of those. Well, I have one. I've never used it. Says I'm just not in a situation where I'd be like, oh, let me give you my number. And I pull out this really cool card.
I guess if you're like dating, like if you're still like out in the dating scene.
Yes. Then I would definitely need that card.
Yeah. Cause then you're like, yeah, you know, here's my information. Here's where I work. Like it gives you all that, you know, cause you got to get to know somebody. It's just an easier way to get to know somebody right then.
Everybody is doing the pre-scout as Alabama Adriana taught us a couple years ago. And she said, it's shady if you don't have social media. You're not just a reclusive person. You're shady if you don't have the socials. All right. We got Punch It Audio coming up. We got to talk about the college football playoff national championship game and a whole bunch more.